session number 24609,
Reel 3. Then there was an Australian fellow called Crawford, Ozzie Crawford. There was Barney Barnes, the sergeant, that he was the electrician in the unit. And Streaky Veal was one of the new guys that were posted in with us. So we all settled down to make a good life of ourselves. We didn't have any pressure as far as parades or anything like that. We just got up in the morning and got in a truck and went up to the main camp and had breakfast. Came back and went to our jobs. My job turned out to be what I really liked. I really loved that job, was in charge of the motorcycle section. I was always interested in motorcycles. And also I was in charge of the gasoline and oil stores, looking after the accounts, trying to keep the books straight for gasoline and oil. I was also in charge of the water supply, making sure that we had clean water to drink and plenty of water for showers. I was also in charge of the fire precautions, the fire buckets, the fire extinguishers, the hoses, and we had a fire pump, a trailer type fire pump. I had to make sure all these things were in working order. But we had so much work to do, there was only 8 of us. Eventually there were 3 more posted in, which made 11. And we had a busy time. We were always doing something. I was trying to balance the books at the oil store, or I was road testing motorcycles. But we were kept really busy. During the weekends, of course, we were allowed to go down to Singapore, and we all had leave passes for 48 hours almost every weekend. So we used to use Singapore as our main area of recreation for a local, maybe just for the evening or something like that, or during the day we go down to Johor Bahru and go through the bars and restaurants there. But on the whole, we began to enjoy a very good life in Malaya. The, like I say, the climate was not the best for us. We suffered from, or some people did, from foot diseases with sweating and things like that. But on the whole, we were a pretty healthy group. The camp itself was reasonably isolated. At night, of course, like I said, we had to stay in and confined a camp in the curfew area. But The curfew around the camp was very strictly enforced. As soon as it got dark, the gates of the camp were closed, and they weren't opened until daylight hours the next day. But we had, like I say, our own quarters inside the camp, and we got made up a large box, a large wooden box, and we had a metal steel container that was originally some kind of a gas bottle that we cut the top off and fashioned a lid for it. And we put this inside the wooden box and surrounded it with lots of sawdust as insulation, and we used to use it as an ice box. So we always had cold beer and Coca-Cola or something like that, and we used to keep it well stocked. The evening hours were spent sitting around. Some of us used to write letters or read, or most of us would drink. And the time passed comparatively easily. We didn't have any restrictions or anything like that. What we did do was Captain Newlove, the CO, would insist that we did a patrol of the workshop now and again during the night. So when one of us felt like going to the washroom, we would take a stand gun with us, and we'd just walk around the perimeter of the workshop. Usually two of us would go just to check out the fence, make sure there was no terrorists that cut holes in the fence or anything like that. One of the our pride and joy was a washroom. It was just a small hut down at the edge of the swamps that we had a toilet with it wouldn't flush, but it had a tank of water sitting on the roof of the toilet, and a pipe going down to the toilet itself. And it was a china toilet, and it was encased in a wooden box with a lid on it that kept out the bugs and lizards and stuff like that. Well, one day we had a craftsman with us called James, Ticker James, we used to call him, and he was not a very big man, but one evening he said, "Well, I'm going to go down to the toilet," and he took a stand and went, and it wasn't too long, and we heard a scream and him hollering, and we all dashed down the stairs with a stand, and we saw him running back from the toilets, and he said, "There's a huge great snake in the toilet bowl." And we went in and lifted the lid of the toilet bowl, and we were just in time to see the tail end of the what proved to be I can't think of the name of the snake now. It was a python. And we dashed outside the toilet and shone our flashlights down on the pipe that came out from the toilet into the swamp and into the river. And just in time to see the snake come out of the pipe, and we figured he must have been about 16, 18 feet long. But it scared the hell out of Ticker James, that's for sure. Ticker James was later to leave the camp and go up further north to another unit, and it was the news was sent back to us that he had committed suicide. His girlfriend had sent him a Dear John letter, and he was that kind of a guy that just couldn't take it, I guess. Anyway, life went on in the camp. We, during the day, we would get up, get in the truck, go up to the main camp in the GD barracks, have our breakfast, which usually consisted of porridge and stewed kidneys on toast, or there would be some kind of, I think we had bacon and eggs once a week on a Sunday, probably because they figured not too many people got out of bed on Sunday for breakfast. So we had bacon and eggs on Sunday, but the rest of the week would be porridge, and sometimes reconstituted egg on toast, sometimes cereal. But the food, although army food, we didn't really mind it that much. Our main delight was when we got into town, into Singapore or Johor Bahru, going in and have Indian curry and rice, or Chinese type food. So we didn't really mind that much. After breakfast, we came back to the camp and we all went about our own duties. Mine was usually confined to the motorcycle section. I would have to road test the motorcycles as they were being serviced and repaired by the 10 civilian fitters that I had working for me. I think five of them were Chinese, and three of them were Malay, and two were Indians, and I used to get along really well with them. They would bring me in my lunch, which consisted of a banana leaf with fried rice with shrimp and little pieces of pork and vegetables and stuff like that. Wrapped up in this banana leaf and tied up with a piece of string, and that would keep it nice and moist until lunchtime. Then we'd all sit around and have lunch together. When it was time to road test the motorcycles, I had a permanent pass, or I forget what they used to call them now, but permission to be out on the motorcycle. I take a motorcycle and go out through the camp gates, and you go about, I think it's about half a mile south, and then you turn off on a test route that cut across that part of the island out to the west coast of Malaya. And I drive this test route, and at the end of the test route, there was a house that was owned by a Eurasian man called Douglas Frank. He was part Dutch and part Malay, and he had a Norton Dominator motorcycle at that time, and of course I was very interested in motorcycles, and I used to go down and talk to him. On the way out, sometimes I would be stopped by the CO, Captain Nula, and he'd say, "Where's your Sten gun?" And I said, "I can't drive a motorcycle and sort of carry a Sten gun at the same time. You sling it across your shoulder on a sling, but every time you went over a bump, of course, the Stan Gum would dig into your back, and it's quite uncomfortable. But he said, you're supposed to be armed when you leave the camp. And he used to tear a strip off me about leaving without being armed. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, could you get me a revolver, a sidearm? And he sort of threw up his hands in horror kind of thing. Privates and corporals don't carry sidearms, that's for officers only kind of thing. So I never did get a sidearm to wear when I was riding motorcycles. But I never did have any problem with ambushes by terrorists or anything like that. Some of the guys did, they were fired at from the side of the road, but they didn't stop, they just drove straight on. The gasoline and oil store, I had to do the accounts for that every month. This was supposed to mean the job of CSM Tug Wilson, but he put the job off onto me, which I wasn't too pleased about, but he outranked me anyway. And after we'd been in the camp a couple months, Gabby Hayes, my buddy, and myself were elevated to the dizzy ranks of Lance Corporal. And this didn't really bother me that much. I wasn't very promotion agitated in those days. But we were told we could wear Lance Corporal's stripes, so what it entailed in those days was on your uniform, of course, you had your Lance Corporal's stripes sewn on. If you just wore shorts and boots and a hat, you wore a leather or fabric cuff around your wrist with brass, with your brass rank on there. In my case, there would be one brass stripe. If you were a CSM, well then of course you wore your brass crown on there. And this was a way of distinguishing different ranks. Well, you didn't have jackets on. The other ranks in the workshops in 221, there was I think three or four privates, and there was a couple Lance Corporals. Smudger Smith was a corporal. He was soon to return to England. His time was up. Ozzy Crawford, he was a corporal. Barney Barnes, a sergeant. And then CSM Tug Wilson. There was a lieutenant that was on staff. We didn't see too much of him. And then, of course, there was Captain Newlove and Captain Cooper. We spent most of the day doing what was considered our normal work. Me testing motorcycles, checking out the fire equipment. Usually I did that once a week. The water supply was usually done about twice a week. The system we had for that was, we had an old Jeep that most of the body work was taken off it. And there was a wooden box for us to sit on to drive. And there was a wooden box in the back with a water pump on it that was connected by a sprocket and chain to the drive shaft that was disconnected to the rear wheels, and a sprocket welded onto the output for the drive shaft. And when you wanted to use the water pump, you put the Jeep in gear, and this would operate the back that drive shaft and turn the water pump, and you could pump water. if you wanted to drive the Jeep, you just put it in four-wheel drive and disengage the front drive shaft, and you could drive away. I used to take this Jeep out into the village, and across the road there was an old pineapple factory that the Japanese destroyed during the war, and in there was a very good source of water, which was a fairly deep well. The well was connected to a pipe system that came out of the factory, went across the road, under the road, and into the camp, and to a large concrete tank built on top of one of the buildings. So I would go over, set the Jeep up, put the inlet pipe with a filter on it down into the well, and the other end of the pump I would connect up to this pipe that ran across the road, and set the pump going, pump the water out across the road and into this large tank, which was used for filling up the radiators of the trucks with water, water for us to shower, and stuff like that. So